This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Throughout Cincinnati, residents, community leaders, and organizations are working to improve conditions in their neighborhoods. But pulling off the needed changes takes a lot of careful planning and coordination. And that's where the Neighborhood Playbook comes in. It's a new tool to bring investment and positive change to communities. Joining us to discuss the Neighborhood Playbook are Walnut Hills Redevelopment Foundation Executive Director Kevin Wright and MKSK Senior Associate and Street Sense co-founder Joe Nickel. They received a People's Liberty Project grant to help them create the playbook. And you can join the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Joe and Kevin, thanks so much for being here this afternoon.
Thanks for having us.
So Kevin, describe this to me. What is the Neighborhood Playbook? Why did you decide to create this?
So the Neighborhood Playbook is a field guide for both developers and community members to find ways to create demand for place and to draw in real estate investment and development to their communities. It was started as an idea between Joe and I, who got to know each other through our work in Walnut Hills, my work at the Redevelopment Foundation, and Joe's work as a consultant. And we started talking about really two different problems that we saw out there that we saw happen to see a connection between. One problem on the community side was that typically communities put a lot of effort and a lot of work into community planning and to events and cleanups and then tend to stop. So a lot of times they'll show up, they'll give their input, a plan will be developed, the plan will be placed on a shelf, and they'll sort of sit back and expect the neighborhood to start to change on its own. On the other hand, we also recognized that there was a lot of emerging demand for urban places and urban neighborhoods, and the developers that we knew and talked to understood that and wanted to invest big in neighborhoods and urban places, but there weren't enough neighborhoods or communities where the risk was low enough that they could enter the market. And so the development of the playbook kind of emerged from that. And the playbook is sort of a tool we can put in people's hands, whether you're a community member or a developer, to find ways to lower the risk for real estate development and investment in urban places.
So from what I'm gathering, though, a lot of the problem here is there's no follow-up. You come up with a plan, you start the plan, but then you never keep it going. You don't follow up on it. Is that, am I understanding that right, Joe?
Well, and yeah, it's hard to see follow-up. So when you finish a plan and you've got an organization like Kevin's or Sarah's, who was on before, or others who are trying to put together a complicated real estate development deal, to a community member, that looks like nothing's going on. And so what we're trying to do, or one of the things we're trying to do is in developing the playbook, is give shorter-term, bigger wins that the community can actually be a part of that they don't have to necessarily wait around for, so that you can see real activity happening in a place.
So is the analogy here with the playbook that you guys are the coaches?
Yeah, we use that quite a bit.
Yeah, we've said before that if you have the playbook, you're the player, and you're out there on the field making the plays. And each neighborhood has a different field and different context to it, and you're going to have to adjust as you go, but we're here to help. Yes.
So kind of describe the book to me, too, because it's interesting the way this is laid out, Kevin.
Sure.
You've got one section when you look at the front that addresses residents, and then as you're flipping through it and you turn it over, it becomes a book that's aimed more at developers.
Yeah, we had a great design partner on this project, BLDG out of Covington, and they were tasked with essentially the challenge of creating two books within one book. And so the book, effectively, it has five plays that take you step by step through the process of, in essence, getting off your couch, going out into your neighborhood, and creating demand for investment and real estate development within your community, whatever that looks like and whatever you want that to look like. So it has an entry point on one side of the book for community members, your average citizen of a neighborhood, and the other side is for developers who may be a little bit more smart when it comes to real estate development and investment, but a little less smart when it comes to community engagement, community involvement. So the five plays are the same for either side of the book, but they're written for two completely different audiences. And when you get to the end of your side of the book, it gives you a little glimpse through a window into the other side of the book and encourages you to flip it over and say, hey, developer, you should really read the same book from the perspective of the community member. Or, hey, community member, you should really read the same book from the perspective of the developer. And what that does is what Joe made the joke before we started, that it's effectively an empathy tool and gets you to understand the perspective of the other side, which is one of the biggest challenges in community development, is getting community members and developers to work together to grow a place. So one of the lines that we use when we've been talking about the book is development doesn't have to happen to a place. It can happen with a place. And that's a win-win scenario for everyone involved. And we're hoping that the playbook acts as a formula, so to speak, to help neighborhoods across Cincinnati and across the Midwest and elsewhere really take on a new approach to how they grow neighborhoods.
So maybe more so in terms of the resident side, is this a kind of a grassroots approach to community development?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's on its face very much a we want change, we want real estate development, physical change in our neighborhoods. It is a real estate development tool. But what we've seen in Walnut Hills and Joe has seen in other neighborhoods he's worked in across the country is that it can two or three people coming together and saying, hey, there's a problem in my neighborhood I want to solve. They can start small and affect really big change. And so it is very grassroots.
And it harks back to, I think, a little bit of a historical perspective on how places like Cincinnati developed over time. Another metaphor we use quite often is the supply and demand metaphor, where a lot of places, a lot of neighborhoods, a lot of development focuses on the supply side. How do we build the new building? How do we raise enough money to build the new park or the new street? And what we've and then hope the demand comes. What we've taken on here and have noticed others who are thinking the same way have taken on is really focusing on the demand side first. That with very little investment, you can actually raise the demand level in a place. And that helps inform and shape the outcome of what the building or the public space looks like. And it at the same time, as Kevin mentioned, it lowers the risk of making that investment because you know the demand is there. You know somebody will come to your corner of the universe and smile and buy something and spend some time and come back time and time again before you've made that kind of leap of faith into putting a shovel in the ground.
And Joe, I notice on both sides of the book, whether you're addressing developers or you're addressing residents, the word amenities mm-hmm. keeps popping up a lot. What do you mean by an amenity?
So yeah, that's a word we arrived at, after a lot of thought. And when a developer is looking for sites, they don't necessarily want to be the one that has to invent everything. They want to be near something that they can use as a selling tool. They want to be near the coffee shop or the bar or the grocery store or whatever the case may be, and they can use that as a way to sell apartments or condos or additional retail space. And so well-amenitized neighborhoods are key to this kind of walkable urban place that development is clamoring to. On the other side, in the kind of neighborhood side of things, neighbors are always looking for, oh, man, I wish I had that coffee shop or I wish I had that bar within walking distance. I'm tired of going to the next neighborhood over or across the freeway to get to that place. And so the amenity creation is kind of one of those points where both the developers who are looking for it and the communities are looking for it, it's a way of kind of walking that path together and trying to attract that kind of mutual goal into a place.
And I overheard you hit on this a little bit with the conversation with Sarah in Madisonville. So what Joe's essentially saying is those two sides want the same thing. For a developer to enter a new market, they want to see that someone else has already shown that demand can be created. And typically, and we see this in Walnut Hills, just like Madisonville, when you ask the community what they want, you hear the same four or five things over and over: a coffee shop, a restaurant, walkability, a grocery shop, et cetera. So how can community members, instead of doing that plan that says we want our business district to be revitalized and have a mix of retail and residential, how can they actually take that next step and sort of create that amenity that draws people to a place and shows demand? And while that's happening, and the book sort of walks you through this, you're inviting developers in to see that happen. And you're saying to them, hey, you know, all we did was throw a little event here and we got 500 people to show up. And we've been doing that monthly. See that building over there? You could develop that and create permanent amenities and permanent residential and make money. The other benefit of that to a community because we hear concerns a lot about gentrification and displacement and who is development for, is that by the very nature of showing up and creating the amenity that you want, you are essentially taking control of what development looks like in your community, and you're shaping it, and you're inviting people in to build what you have created. And it, what we've seen is that it alleviates some fear, and the result can be development that isn't thought of as development, that is thought of as something that we all came together and brought to the neighborhood. In Walnut Hills, two examples of that would be Fireside Pizza and Just Q and Barbecue, which are two of our first big retail openings. And they've been widely embraced by all walks of life in the community, in part because the community has been so active in the last 3 years in getting their hands dirty in drawing in that investment. And so we think this could eventually be a tool for neighborhoods to not be afraid of development, to embrace it, and to make it their own.
So, Kevin, you're talking about fear. What does seem to be the biggest misperception that neighborhoods often have when they're looking at a new project moving into the community?
Well, and you know, I'd hesitate almost to call it a misperception. In some cases, it's reality. I think people see development happen in places throughout the country, and oftentimes it is very top-down, and it is very much outside-driven. So in some cases, it is a misperception. In some cases, it's real. But I think the concerns are displacement of long-term residents through increased property values that are brought on by new development. A lot of questions of who is this for? So who is going to reap the benefits of this? Who are going to be employed by the construction jobs that come with this, or the retail jobs that come with this? And that becomes, you know, a step sort of after the playbook, a problem that needs to be solved after the neighborhood begins to develop momentum, and really is more of a larger policy issue around putting inclusionary policies in place to make sure that there are jobs for people in the neighborhood, and that the businesses that move to a neighborhood are representative racially and culturally of the neighborhood. But that's a very important step in the evolution of a neighborhood, for sure. We've seen that in Walnut Hills.
Is this making developers more inclined to work with the community?
We hope so. We hope that's where it comes from. We've seen it work elsewhere, and obviously the book was just put out there into the world 3 weeks ago. So we'll see how it's embraced.
So what can I respond? Oh, go ahead, Joe.
Well, just to build on that, the developer response has been quite good. We knew that it, because we're both very much involved in the community level, that the community side of things was going to be popular and beneficial for them. But we were more curious about what would happen with the developer community. And Kevin and I were with a Urban Land Institute group a couple weeks ago. And we kind of went through the same kind of conversation with them. And we were really taken aback by the kind of creativity and enthusiasm that they brought into doing this. We really do think that this is a bridge past the kind of age-old dilemma of who goes first. You know, in one community, it may be the neighborhood that's leading this. But in other respects, it could be a developer who says, I really like this neighborhood in my gut. Tells me that it's going to be great, but there's no kind of infrastructure there to make that play viable. I can use this as a tool to prove to my investment partners, to prove to the neighborhood, to prove to my market that I've got a real thing here. And people recognize that. The developers recognize that. And so the calls that we're getting, the people that are interested in participating in this book or asking us for advice, It's an equal cross-section from the communities to the developers and investors.
How many copies of the book are out there, Kevin?
Well, we had a kickoff event at People's Liberty, and we gave the first 50 people who attended got a free copy. And that was our People's Liberty, part of our People's Liberty money at work, because these cost some money to print because they're so uniquely designed. But we have an on-demand printer that we use now. So you can order the book online at neighborhoodplaybook.com, and we just have an unlimited number that we can print as people purchase them.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join us. So let's talk with Bonnie in Loveland. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi. I just had a quick comment. It seems oftentimes when development happens, a great number of sort of larger mature trees are removed in the process, and, you know, tiny little 2 or 3 year old trees are planted in their place. And so I wondered if you guys could address the challenges of trying to create either new structures or, you know, modify existing structures without degrading the trees.
Okay. Thank you, Bonnie.
Sure.
Thanks, Bonnie. I'll attempt to answer that. So we talk a lot about the characteristics of places that you look for when you are deploying the playbook methodology. And oftentimes when you get to a place, you know, the possibilities are endless and you need some kind of constraint to kind of get you going and kind of limit the possibilities. One thing that we look for when we're looking for that first play, which is find a place, is something that feels like an outdoor room. And this is one of those places that kind of we deviate from a traditional development arc. A traditional development pattern is, okay, I've got a site. It may have buildings on it. It may have trees on it. It's X acres. I can fit this on it. Let's do it. The playbook says, okay, look what you have, both in terms of buildings, trees, surfaces, edges, and say, where is the outdoor room on this site? And some of the inspiration that we've seen and where this has been done very well is actually leveraged the creation of that outdoor room through trees. One example comes to mind. The Texas Truck Yard outside Dallas had a very small, humble building and then 4 kind of large old-growth trees that created this canopy of an outdoor room. In Texas, this was particularly useful given its weather. And they actually capitalized on those quite a bit and even turned one of the trees into a kind of occupiable treehouse. And what traditionally would have been flattened and used as a kind of development site suddenly became the centerpiece to all the development that happened around it and kind of became a de facto public space. And so I hope that answers your question. I think it can be used as a tool to figure out where and what development looks like and address some of those issues.
Yeah, it goes back to that mindset you used in creating the book about development should not happen to a place. It should happen with a place.
Right. I think – yeah, that's right. And I think when you have a plan that's, you know, your sort of typical plan that says here's a development site on a map, what often happens is what Joe says is that site gets flattened and something gets built on it. Now, when you allow people to interact with that same space, you might see value in things that you never would have seen before. And that trees are a great example, as Joe said. You might understand that trees are a really great natural piece to the site. Alleyways maybe are drawn more to your attention as something you should keep. We see this as a great historic preservation tool. Even some historic buildings that typically are torn down, the smaller one-story buildings, we see is when people tend to interact with space, we find more value in those. Now, conversely, some of those we might learn the opposite, that some trees need to be torn down or some buildings need to be torn down, but it's influenced by people interacting with space, and one of the plays in the playbook is evaluating. So as people interact, you're taking photos, you're taking notes, and the book is designed to be shoved in your pocket and drawn in and written in. And so you're saying, okay, we're surprised that people congregated under these trees. We should probably keep those trees, or we should probably do something with those trees. So that may have sounded like a strange question to some people, but actually it's really a great example of the overall theme of the playbook, which is we don't know what's valuable until we put people in a place and watch them either embrace it or not embrace it.
How tough is it to execute these 5 plays that you have in the book? Is this something that pretty much anybody can pull off?
So as part of our rollout, we were obviously very focused on the production of the book, but our end goal was not a book. It was seeing it actually be used. And so as part of the way we designed our People's Liberty grant, we wanted to get it into the hands of some folks. So starting in July, with the help of our hometown, Bellevue, the book in its beta form was put in the hands of 5 unsuspecting residents. And kind of going back to the player-coach metaphor, we kind of helped out and participated in executing the five plays and walked that walk with them, and we're taking our own mental notes to see how the community was interacting with it, the community, the leadership, these five folks were interacting with it. And they were able to develop what became the Old Kentucky Makers Market in Bellevue on the 700 block of Fairfield Avenue. And they, in a few weeks, they'll have the third iteration of it. And every single time, it gets better. And they're going through this methodology time and time again. They're going back and kind of tinkering with things after they find out what works, what doesn't. And the level of sophistication and the attraction to this kind of forlorn block of the avenue keeps getting better time and time again. And it's amazing. In July, these five folks did not think of themselves as community developers, and now they're all, in one way or another, experts at it. And they continue to learn and innovate and create something that this book couldn't anticipate. We're very careful not to lead somebody to the answer with this, but provide the steps for others to find the answer. We didn't want to predetermine any outcome.
So it's a workbook.
It is, very much so.
It is.
You want to get people working with this book, mm-hmm. not just reading it.
That's right.
Joe and Kevin, thank you so much for joining me
thank
this
you for
afternoon.
Having us. Great. Thank you.
The creators of the Neighborhood Playbook, Walnut Hills Redevelopment Foundation Executive Director Kevin Wright, and MKSK Senior Associate and StreetSense Co-Founder Joe Nickel. You can find a link to more information about the Neighborhood Playbook at WVXU.org. Thanks for joining me this afternoon and listening to Cincinnati Edition. You can find archives of our programs at WVXU.org. The producer for today's show was Pete Reitmeier with help from Kevin Reynolds. The assistant producer was Belinda Kai. Dave Shermer was the technical director. I'm Mark Haney. Stay tuned for Here and Now next on 91.7 WVXU. And join us tonight at 9 for NPR's coverage of the third and final presidential debate. If your garden produced more fruits and vegetables this season than you can eat fresh, there are several ways to preserve them for use throughout the winter. On the next Cincinnati Edition, our horticultural experts join us to discuss canning, freezing, and other food preservation methods. They'll also explain how to find and store seeds for planting next year, and they'll answer your gardening questions. That's on Cincinnati Edition, Thursday afternoon at 1 on 91.7 WVXU.